Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 14, I'm joined by Lauren Playdell-Pierce, Executive Creative Director for PwC. Lauren received an advanced diploma in digital design from the Carl Vaughan Institute and has gone on to work for some of the biggest global enterprises such as Wunderman, Fabric, and Razorfish. Her creative direction has focused campaigns for brands such as Shell, Legal & General, Heineken, Coca-Cola, British Telecom, and KFC, which won the British Arrows Gold Award for It Doesn't Count If campaign. She was also awarded a Creative Circle Silver for Digital Craft, a Gold DMA for Best Use of Data, and a Bronze in Financial Services. She was also celebrated within Campaign's 2017 Top 30 Future Creative Leaders. She also mentors at Buckinghamshire New University, is a regular judge for the DNAD Annual Awards, and also a judge for Jolt, an organisation that helps talented creatives from every kind of background get into advertising. And she is part of Creative Equals, the inspiration and motivation that set this podcast in motion. Lauren, it is with great delight to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
That's like a whole time warp, like to go through all of that. It's crazy to hear it all in one go.
Pretty awesome though.
Time flies when you're having fun, yeah. I think.
I'm wondering if we can start off, if you can tell me, what is Executive Creative Director?
That's a really fascinating question, because I think I can tell you what it is to be the role that I'm in now, but Executive Creative Director does change depending on where you are, what your outputs are, what stage you are. Yeah. Are you in a holding company? Are you in an independent? Are you a studio and so on? So for me, I work in the leadership team at the Experience Centre at PwC. And we work on PwC client challenges. So any sort of strategic challenges that they might be facing around coming out with new products, looking at new audiences, working on new brands, developing new spatial experiences, for instance, for like retail. They'll come to us and we will use all of our skills and we'll come up with those solutions. So as part of the leadership team, what my role is to work with the chief experience officer and also our team leader, which I always find is a weird title.
Chief experience officer, though.
Chief experience officer is another very, I know these titles honestly are just ridiculous in our industry. And we will work on the strategic objectives for our team. So for FY19, what are we looking to do? What type of work are we looking to go for? All the way down into things like, you know, memberships and getting, you know, DNAD membership and Tate and stuff like that. And even subscriptions. I'm looking at subscriptions this week all through, like, you know, getting Creative Review and campaign. You know, so there's a lot of stuff around just setting all of that up. And then I'm also responsible very much for the culture and to make sure that we have the dynamic right with the people that we bring in, that we have the culture for them to do the best work possible, which is always a very tricky sort of line to go across. And then I oversee all of the outputs, essentially. So my background is visual design, where the chief experience officer would be looking at things around experience strategy, for instance. I review everything around visual design, branding, creative, you know, that massive umbrella. And then we tend to come together in the middle on experience design because it's very much a collaborative effort. So I do have to keep my eyes across everything, which is challenging but good, whilst kind of running all of those other things in parallel. And also doing things like R&D, you know, coming up with things that the team can tackle for them to, you know, get into and stretch out their legs on and so on. So, yeah, actually listing all of that off in one go, it's quite a bit.
I was going to say, how do you manage that? How do you segment it up? Because you've got, like you're saying, you're overseeing that creative umbrella, that arm. Then you've got kind of, like you said, looking for future work, then R&D, then the financials. How do you manage all that?
Prioritization is really important. I actually have an app called Things, which I'm sure lots of people do. But within there, I actually have to write down everything, like literally even personal, like remember it's blah blah blah's birthday and stuff, because I find things going one ear out the other. And so I tend to put everything in there, and then I actually have to go back to my objectives for the year. Mm-hmm. So there are objectives that are laddering up to just a PwC objectives. Mm-hmm. And then there's also objectives, like I said before, of like the Experience Centre. And then I have some personal ones, you know, I want to mm-hmm. support as well. I actually keep those as a sticky note mm-hmm. on my laptop screen. This is going to make me sound really OCD. To review on a pretty regular basis. Mm-hmm. And use that as a lens to make sure that I'm prioritizing the right things at the right time. Mm-hmm. If you can't prioritize, I find that it feels too overwhelming, or you focus on something perhaps you really love, mm-hmm. which might not actually be the best thing for the team or the best thing for you or the best thing for anyone really. And you'll discover that it'll be a couple of days later and you're like, hang on a second, what's going on? So prioritization definitely, and self-awareness, like being aware of the things which I find I gravitate to, or I fall into traps doing, or, you know, I get distracted by, definitely makes, it makes a really big difference having that self-awareness.
It's going to sound really naive on my part, but I would have never thought there would have been a creative department within PwC.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
Is it something relatively new, or has it been established in there for a long time?
No, well, yes and no, actually, because there's probably 20 to 25 experience centres around the world. Mm-hmm. So in places that you would naturally expect, like New York, Sydney, New Zealand, Bangkok, Shanghai, Stockholm, Frankfurt, I mean, just absolutely everywhere. Some of them are acquisition, so mm-hmm. a little bit, but like Accenture getting Fjord and so on like that. Mm-hmm. So a couple of them are about 300 people.
Okay.
So quite large, well-developed agencies. And then a few of the others, including ourselves, are growing organically. So mm-hmm. I think I was employee number 5 in July.
Okay.
And we're now 30. So there's been quite a lot of recruitment going on.
That's a huge scale up.
Very big scale up.
Yeah.
Hence why I was talking about balancing all those things.
Yeah.
But we, like I said before, tackle just literally PwC client challenges. Mm-hmm. And they're across every single industry. And I think these requirements have been out there within PwC, you know, for quite a while, mm-hmm. really, but they've not really had the capability in order to be able to respond to them fully. Mm-hmm. They do to a certain degree, but they haven't really had like a design department in that way.
Can you tell me what was your career journey up until this point?
Yeah. Definitely not very linear, mm-hmm. as I'm sure most people in the creative industry are the same. So So I was going to study law, and then I ended up choosing art. Uh-huh. And then I ended up actually at the University of New South Wales doing media and communications. It was like the first year that degree happened. And like you mentioned, I ended up transferring actually, because in the first year I was just doing English, philosophy and film studies. Uh-huh. And I'm like, this is all really interesting, but I can't really see where this is going. And it wasn't really tapping into what I wanted to do, which was to actually design things and create things. Mm-hmm. So I switched to doing a pure sort of graphic design degree, which was great, and joined a tiny little agency, and they transferred me. I was there for about 3 years, kind of as my junior sort mm-hmm. of years there. And they just one day decided to open up a place in London, and my like boss at the time was like, do you want to go over to the London office and help us, you know, recruit people into the office mm-hmm. and, you know, do all of that? And I was like, yes.
Wow.
I don't think I
That's
even
incredible.
Really like, I didn't even consider it. I don't think like the impact at the time when I made the decision. And I had about 2.5 weeks, and I found someone to move into my like house that I was sharing with flatmates and sold my car and like freighted everything. And I think I was on the plane before it really dawned on me what I had done.
Yeah.
And it was actually a whole 8 years until I went back as well, but that's a whole other story for another time. And I came over, and I was here for 4 months, and then they made me redundant.
What?
I know. It was one of those moments.
I was about to say, like, what a fantastic opportunity, but also not to say that being redundant isn't an opportunity, but what a shock.
I know. I was like, so they said to me on the phone, they're like, actually, you know, that's going well, but we want you to come back. And I was like, but I've just figured out like what British Gas is and where the supermarket is. And I just settled into an apartment. And they were saying, well, actually, we decided to put like, you know, all of the creative and so on, you know, back in Sydney. And I was like, so what happens if I don't want to go back? They were like, wow. And that's when I was made redundant.
Oh, wow.
And some crazy part of me was like, okay, let's just give this a go and see what happens. And I went to Munich for the World Cup, and then I went and lived in Barcelona for a while. Had like a little mini break. And then I came back and I started contracting, and the just to get a sense, because I didn't even know what a agency was here, like the good agency. I was on Google just trying to figure all of that out. And I contracted somewhere for a week at a place called DNA, and I was there for a week just to help out at the end of like a web build. And then they extended me a week, and then they extended me for a month, and then in the end I was there for 6 years. And DNA became Razorfish, which is why I ended up there.
And what were you doing in those 6 years?
So I focused on visual design. I was working on things like NSPCC, McDonald's, Samsonite, lots of different like big brands that would come to Razorfish, essentially for like web builds or creative campaigns. That's kind of at the time, they were the two main things that you went to Razorfish for. And my responsibility, I kind of went from midweight into senior designer and then into design lead whilst I was there. And when I was design lead, I pitched and won Audi in the UK. And that was really the first time that they had really redone all of their brand. It was during the, I don't know if you remember the ads, but they were like white on white with white. They were super minimal. And they wanted to understand how they could translate their brand now into an entire digital experience. And that was a huge piece of work. I oversaw over 14,000 different photographic assets and films, and as well as the web build itself. And but I did get to test drive some cars, so
that's pretty
awesome. Yeah, swings and roundabouts, you know.
And did you sleep much during that period?
No. There was not a lot of sleep, not a lot of social life. But I did meet my husband, my now husband. So that probably correlates at the same time, and. Yeah, it was an amazing experience, and a chance for me really to kind of lead something of that scale properly. And I was doing it for about a year and a half. And at the end of that, unfortunately, there was no way for me to transfer onto another client. At the time, they were very much tying you to single clients, which, you know, now that I'm in a sort of an ECD role, I look back on it going, that just is absolutely insane, because you want people to be fresh and work on different things and keep each other motivated. So to tie someone to it for that long is kind of quite detrimental, really.
For the brand as well.
You do tend to kind of start living in a bubble. You understand the brand inside and out. We wrote the brand guidelines, and then you end up kind of, ideas would come in and you're like, well, it would work with this, but it won't work with that. And you just can't help but fall into that pattern and behavior. And so I decided, actually, at the time, lots of friends were going out contracting. And I thought, again, I would, you know, I didn't really make it very far previously in seeing other London agencies. And so this was my real chance to get out there. And 2 months, this is just going to repeat over and over, but 2 months after I left, the old MDs of Razorfish, although the MDs of DNA that became Razorfish, but they contacted me saying they wanted to start another new agency and kind of build it up in the same way. There was only five of them. Did I want to join them and, you know, help build the creative team? I was like, yeah, but, you know, I'm contracting. I want to see the world. And then I ended up being there for 4 years. it was too much fun. And it was the first time in my entire life I was given a chance to create without boundaries. So we had the chance to define the brief. The clients were coming to us with no preconceptions of what we could do. So we won Heineken within like the first like 40 days of us being there, which was a shock to all of us at the time. I remember we were like, there's six of us. This is interesting. But it was a chance. So they would actually just give us, again, challenges, you know, and we would look at that and say, well, no, that's not a web build. Like, why would you want to do that? No, you should do this, or you should do an event, or you should do an experiential thing, or you should do a coffee table book, or you should. And so I really got a chance to, you know, stretch my legs out and doing lots of stuff. And that's hilariously when the British Arrows thing came along for KFC, which became one of our other clients. And the 4 years was amazing. I had so much fun. And then at the end of that, we were actually bought by WPP. And kind of brought into the land of grey and possible and so on. And I moved over to an agency called Wonderman to help them set up their visual design team and customer experience team over there. And I was there for 3 years doing exactly that, which was great. And so I've kind of gone through this unusual cycle, I suppose, of like large agency, small agency, large agency. And now I'm essentially in an incubator of, like I said, now 30 people. So again, I've gone back quite small because I realised the things that I was most passionate about was, one hand was people and culture and setting things up. I love that feeling of growing something. And then the other part of it was actually really lovely sort of challenges where you don't get a brief. You just get a sense of like, well, this isn't resonating with this customer, or we don't understand what's going on here. Can you just help us, you know, get that sorted? And I just love doing that. And then I love being able to see something happen at the end of it, which you can look at and go, that was us. Like that was the tangible impact that we had on people's lives. And that's kind of why I've now been drawn back into the crazy world of consultancy.
Okay. So that's a nice segue into, who do you typically work with? What is a typical day, if there's a typical day?
I'm not sure there is a typical day, actually. There's a certain cadence, probably, to the day. And there's a certain element of me now applying a different methodology to the way I'm working. And I'll explain in a sec. Because the cadence for me previously was non-stop conversations, essentially. Particularly at this stage in what I'm doing, I have had a small hiatus from doing actual visual design work, in the sense of the things I need to tackle are things around setting things up and so on. So naturally it's taken me kind of a little bit off the path of producing visual design, and now I'm getting back onto that again, which is lovely. Always love it. I can't give it up. So we tend to do our stand-ups and that sort of regularity to keep in contact. But I am in a different environment than a studio environment, which I'm trying to get used to, because everyone is essentially how to describe it, like a self-initiated entrepreneur. So consultancy as a way of working and just a mindset is something I've never seen before. And everyone is responsible. So you're automatically trusted and responsible for your outputs. And you automatically own the thing you're working on, and it's up to you to drive that through. So essentially, where in studios or in agencies, you would get a normal cadence of someone working on something, perhaps supporting a lead or supporting a creative director or anything along those lines. They'd have kind of regular check-ins and so on. That's not the same thing. So people will run these whole, you know, streams of work, it's very impressively, like by themselves. And then I only check in with you like three times in the whole thing, you know, so the it's kind of a, it's an unusual thing that I'm trying to get adjusted to. And I'm trying to understand how much studio way of working do we really want to overlay on this amazing entrepreneurial spirit. But I have instigated deep working time for myself. So I block out a period of 9 till 11:30 every day. And within that time period, it's a chance for me to actually think about some of those larger strategic challenges we want to solve, get my mind into projects, catch up on something. You
Does
know,
that
really,
mean no one else can contact you? You're not looking at emails. You're just absolutely focused.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those things where I'd read a lot about having deep working time and having that focus time where you really just shut down from everything else for quite a while. And it's been impossible to actually, you know, have that realistically happen. Previously it was like a team of 45 in an open plan office and, you know, eight projects running concurrently. So it was impossible. Whereas now, because we're starting to set up, we're also setting up our methodologies and we're setting up our general approach and behavior and our personality. So I feel like now is the one moment.
Put it right in there at the ground level.
I'm going to put it in there. And, you know, realistically, there are a few things that always fall into those times where I just can't shift anything around. And I'm like, fine, this will work. But I do then try and put it closer to like the end of the time, or I replace it. And I was like, okay, you know what? There's too many things that need to happen at that period in the morning on this day. I'm going to move my time to like the afternoon, or I'm going to shift it so it's not, you know, in cement. That is definitely helping a lot.
I am loving the sound of deep thinking
time. Yeah.
Just to be able to just focus as well. That's why, I mean, you're juggling, like you're saying, eight projects and helping the team and getting things signed off. And
it's almost impossible otherwise. Like I remember reading that report saying it takes, you know, approximately 10 minutes or 12 minutes to really get your mind back into a certain topic. So if the average time of my meetings is 20 minutes to like half an hour, By the time I then get into something, then it's literally like, oh, 2 seconds of actually valid input, and then I'm, you know, right back out again. And it's not any way to particularly add value. And then it's all the way back to that prioritization thing again. Where can you add the most value in the time that you have?
So you talked about this entrepreneurial framework that's currently existing. But who are the other team members that you're working with? I know you talked about the chief experience officer, which I love that title.
Yeah, I know.
But kind of in that team of 30 people, kind of what is that made up of?
So we have probably what I would describe as there's the 30 people that's the core team, and then we actually have satellite teams, which I'll run through as well. But so we have, as I was saying before, a leader that kind of heads all of that up, an amazing guy called Tom Adams, chief experience officer, and myself. Like I say, we kind of split a lot of work and collaborate pretty much all the time. And then discipline-wise, we have service designers. We have experience designers. So experience designers for us is quite broad. We actually have architects on the team. So it's spatial experiences, physical experiences. Obviously, then we go into normal kind of UX and, and so on. We actually don't go into implementation very often. So we don't actually have a lot of experienced designers in that regard, where we're going into like web builds. Because for us to lose 10 to 12 people, for instance, in a massive web build is not the best use of all of our amazing brains on something, you know. Visual designers is a little bit similar. So we have people that are ex-Wolf Ollens and Dixon Baxi type style people, so very brand focused. We have people that are far more digitally focused. We have one of our designers actually is teaching herself AI and coding AI, which is just incredible. I'm like, okay, like knock yourselves out. It's amazing. And we've got some designers for VR as well in that space. And then we actually have a cinematographer, and he works on not only helping us generate stuff within the team, so like case study work and so on, but he also works covering workshops. He'll work on client stuff. He'll work on vision pieces. It's just amazing how much he's just like permanently being utilized. It's ridiculous. And then we actually have a co-creation crew. So these guys, there's about 14 of them roughly, and they'll work with clients when it comes to anything around employee engagement, alignments, brand vision alignment. So they can work with up to like sometimes 60 to 80 people from a particular client, and they'll run 1-3 day workshops.
So that's quite epic.
Clear as mud.
Yeah. Exactly. So could you give me just an example of a project that you've worked on? Doesn't you don't need to talk about the brand specifically.
So one of the projects we're working on at the moment is with a fintech. So we've been working with them for a few years actually now, and worked with them around creating their initial product, which is out on the market. And then now we're actually coming up with another new product with them. So we did everything from the value propositions, like where should they be going for, what audiences should they be going for, how do you position it, what does it look like, what does it actually feel like, what are the features, the functions, and then developed their marketing approach and their plan and media strategy. So, I mean, that is compared to an agency where you sometimes do come in kind of at the end where the product's been defined. We are literally at the beginning going, okay, we think we need something to tap into this market. And then we just start. And that's a combination of the research guys. So we have 150 research people. But that was one of the major reasons I joined, actually. I was like, I need to get my greedy mitts on these amazing people. So that was a combination of research. There was a couple of people from customer that work very much around customer experience, which is kind of a crossover what we do. But they also focus hugely on operationally and organizationally. What does the company need to do in order to facilitate this product? How does it actually work? Like hiring, flows, all of that. Then we had our brand designers working on it. We had our UI designers, our experience designers. So that is a slightly what I would say more usual, maybe possible agency type piece. But we're also working on something around the future of a student experience for a university. So there it's really coming down to the fact that a particular university has started to move up in the rankings and doesn't quite know why, but wants to keep it going. Mm. It's like, oh, hang on a second. We've made a few adjustments, but we're not sure what it is.
Yeah.
So we have spent the last about 2 months actually going into the university with our service designers and experienced designers and essentially running ethnographic studies, doing lots of like job shadowing, journals, interviewing faculty, interviewing students, running workshops that are co-creation stuff around their particular experience.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're about to go into phase two, where we've identified lots of the different opportunities and pain points.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually going to go in and kind of design, you know, and prototype those sort of solutions.
So it's really within the current setup that you're in, you've got this really deep dive, deep insight, deep research, deep data.
Yeah.
And then basically all the tools at your disposal.
It feels a little bit like that. It's kind of going back a little bit when, I joined that startup. We don't get briefs ever.
Mm.
So really these things come through as conversations, and they're conversations with people within PwC, mm-hmm. so within the partner system that's there. I don't know if you know about partners. So it's a little bit like a law firm, and this is how like Deloitte Digital would behave, or an EY, for instance, KPMG and so on. But essentially there's partners that have bought into PwC, and then they also reap the rewards of PwC. They're responsible for not only discrete like client relationships, but they're also responsible for certain disciplines. So they get known for being a specialist in something. Mm-hmm. So they could be a specialist in tax or audit in manufacturing or retail and consumer or something. And so compared to an agency or a studio where you tend to have a system of pitching and then going through to maybe like a biz development team or a crew of people essentially that would look at the opportunity and see, do we want to pitch for it or not? And then you would kind of go in for it. This is a little bit different because it's like having dozens of CEOs that send you opportunities.
Mm.
So there's no centralized... There's no centralized crew of people that evaluate it. It's up to the leadership team and what, you know, I do to talk to these people, understand the opportunity, understand if we can provide value to that opportunity, and then figure it out from there.
It's amazing. So that's why that kind of entrepreneurial spirit exists within that. So it's looking all the time and finding new ways to communicate or experience or...
Very much so. And they do a little bit the same. So partners very much operate in a sense of having conversations with CEOs. So they tend to be either European CEOs, UK and so on, which means their challenges are very strategic, for instance. They're not worried about brand awareness, or they're not worried about launching a product. They're more considered about either employee facing things, or they seem to be going into things like, oh, the next quarter looks like we're dropping down, or we just can't seem to resonate anymore in the UK, like what are we doing? So that's why they come through quite obtuse as challenges, and it's up to us to do the deciphering.
That's fascinating and so different from the studio system.
It took me a while to get my mind around it, and particularly from a creative point of view. So creative directors, and again, it depends where you're located and the scale of your agency, but, you know, coming from a holding company, which I was, a WPP, creative directors don't have control over what you pitch for.
Not at all.
No. So, you know, it would come through as an opportunity within to, like, the management team, and it'd be like, okay, well, we're pitching for X, Y, and Z. Then it would be very much, you know, skills-wise, if it's something, you know, related to, like, visual design or branding or so on, I might jump onto it. Or if it was something more creative comms-focused, someone, like, another CD might do that. But you can't at any stage, A, go back and go, I don't want to pitch on this, or B, it doesn't make sense, or, you know, C, this product isn't going to even be effective. What are we doing, right? You've got no recourse to go back and say anything like that. And it also happens very fast normally. You know, you find out you've got a pitch for something
Three days.
Then it's like, it's like Monday we're starting. You're like, what? Whereas in consultancy, and they, you know, each one does have its own different flavor. But within what we do, some of the opportunities are like long burn, you know, opportunities where you'll be talking with a client for a couple of months maybe about different things, and then it will be sort of a chance to build that relationship up, or they've already got a relationship perhaps with PwC and financial sort of side of things, and then you kind of talk to them a little bit about what you're doing, but it does take a little bit more time.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. I'm so intrigued by that. So can you tell me, what skills do you need to be an effective executive creative director?
I think prioritization is important, and the self-awareness is important. I think being empathetic is important. Understanding what is really driving people. I think helping to set things like objectives and making sure that people can track along those is important because time does fly by so fast. Buffering your team from some of the outside, you know, client things or internal things, I think is an important thing that you don't realise until you get into that role that you actually need to do as well.
Yeah. So where do you go to fuel your own creativity? What do you do? What do you see? How do you manage that?
I am a visual hoarder.
That's a great term.
I'm pretty minimal in real life. Like, I try not to keep too many books and magazines around, but my Pinterest account is one of the places that, I mean, I've got, goodness knows, like 4,000 plus pins that I regularly rotate through over so many different categories. And I also have everything stored in like Pocket, and I have Feedly, and I have, I don't know, like 60 different RSS feeds. And I tend to do a lot of reading and across everything. So I look at, you know, furniture and architecture, and I love science, in not down to the minutiae of science. It wasn't my greatest topic at school, but neuroscience is quite fascinating. Essentially what I do from a design point of view is like the manipulation of human behavior and psychology. So I find those aspects quite interesting, and I really like going to talks, and I like just talking to people. You know, we've got so many different disciplines and skill sets around us, and my husband is like a VP of product as well, and so you kind of tend to get into like debates about stuff, and I think you just need to kind of keep conversing,
keep open.
You just never know where things kind of appear as inspiration. And I do a lot of talks actually as well, which I find forces me to think about my opinion, you know, where you kind of, it's quite easy to waft through life having a general sense of what you think, and then you're asked to put it down into like slides or a talk, and you're like, oh, hang on a second, I really one moment, I really need to think about, you know, what my focus is and what my opinion is. So they kind of help actually to some degree.
So can you tell me what is one of your biggest challenges that you faced?
When I moved over, looking back, I'm not sure I really recognised the challenge I was going through at the time, but I had to adjust my personality temporarily.
So over from Australia to the UK?
Yeah, so when I came over and I joined an agency, out of, goodness, at the time, the design and creative department was about 35 or so. I was only one of two women. And I was actually a freelancer as well, you know, when you're kind of even less sort of feeling of being in that culture and part of the team. I had to tone down my sense of humour. I have a fairly dirty sense of humour. But I found like when the guys in the department were joking and then I'd say something back, they'd just like look at me like...
Death silence.
Yeah. They'd be like, what? Like, and it was just a shock. And I realised I was not a British woman. Client challenges, I've had little ones like along the way, but I haven't really had, like, I've not had one of those that just explodes or, you know, blows up. I've had a project which I worked on for an entire year, and 2 weeks before it was due to launch, it was cancelled by the client. And that was
devastating.
That was devastating. Yeah. I had like a mini funeral. Like literally we went out, we had some like beers and whiskey, and we just kind of like mourned all of the work that we'd done.
So could you tell me what advice would you give someone wanting to be a creative director?
Define what you want to be. Find what you really love. You know, find, like for me, it's problem solving through design. I love that. So it doesn't matter what output it is, you know, like could be the book or the website or an event or anything, but, you know, find out what it is you love and then find the right home. You know, again, I think you start the industry thinking that all the agencies are the same, but culture's different, priorities are different, leadership team is different, and that's quite crucial. Make the difference, I guess, or rather the decision of holding company versus independent versus studio versus, you know, consultancy. I mean, they're all different flavors. So once you find out what you really love to do, once you find out where the home is, you know, where would you find the most comfortable? If your line manager is not setting you objectives, set your own objectives and take it to them and get them to really like force them basically to work with you on what they are. Because often your line manager, depending on who that is, will just let you waft around for a couple of years, and you'll lose years in between where, you know, it's not your responsibility. You often don't know this, you know, at that age. But you'll just kind of stay there and you'll be a situation of like, yeah, just do better, or, you know, and you just won't have any particular guidance. You won't know what training you need, or you won't know that you need to actually push into a leadership role, perhaps on your individual project, for instance, you're working on, or so on. So work with them for objectives, and then work perhaps on your internal profile. So figure out within your ecosystem who your cheerleaders could be. Who knows you? Because being on the other side of the fence now in those leadership meetings, as much as you try not to do it, particularly when you're talking about large scale agencies, people will pop into your mind. Now, those people will be people that you have worked with. So either you've had an experience of working with them on a particular project, or there'll be someone that has approached you or talked to you, or maybe you've had an initiative, right, within the agency that you've worked with them on. And you just can't help but having them forefront in your mind when you're resourcing something. As much as you don't want that to happen, you're like, oh, well, if something comes in from a pitch point of view, it's like, oh, well, blah, 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 I could do this because, you know, I was talking to them the other day about. So figure out who those cheerleaders are for you within whatever the system is, whether you're in an agency of 5, 10, 300. And that would make a very big difference to how you progress. The more people that know what you do, the better that actually is going to be for you. And then find a mentor that is out of your ecosystem of where you are. So I actually didn't have one for quite a few years, and I regret that. And the reason I didn't was I was so wrapped up in my work. I just, the year went by. And I had so many other things I was focusing on, which is why I had to force myself to prioritize better, obviously. And then I was actually talking to Ali Hannan from Creative Equals. And she was chatting to me, and she's like, do you have a mentor? Like, you do mentoring for other people, but have you actually got a mentor? And I was like, no, actually, I haven't for ages now. And doing that, I think, makes a world of difference. I've now got an amazing mentor. And just talking to someone that you know is going through similar challenges is really helpful, particularly if they've gone through the challenges successfully. That's helpful. But I think it's also just a connection to someone else in the industry. You feel, or rather you understand that everywhere has similar things that they're facing. And anywhere that you can basically get a leg up in learning how to quickly get to a successful conclusion is going to be beneficial for you. But it also helps with external networking. You know, it helps for your profile elsewhere, because you don't have to stay obviously at the same studio or agency in order to be promoted. You can, you know, bounce around a little bit and find your home.
Awesome. We've come to the end of our interview. It's been so great talking to you. I've got a whole different perspective on what you do and how you do it, which I really, before I actually had no idea. So, yeah, fantastic. So I'm just wondering what projects you've got coming up in the next few weeks. Almost Christmas, obviously, but maybe in 2019.
So some of the ones I mentioned before are definitely going to track over. So that VR project we're working on, the student experience, is going to be taking a couple more months. We're working actually with a high-end luxury brand on the future of their luxury experience. So they're not very, they don't particularly like e-com, and they don't particularly like being online actually. But they want to go into more innovative ways of bringing interactivity into their boutiques. So that's kind of a fun one. We're working on with our architect and brand designers and so on. We're also working with, if I just say who it is, in the sense of the description, it's going to give it away. But essentially a small town who... has roughly about 250 businesses within the town, and they want to build a sense of community and they want to attract more business. Wow. So honestly, no idea where we're going to start with that one. So that's starting in the new year, and it's just going to be the initial phase of kind of going in there and doing a proper analysis and obviously talking with everyone. So that one's going to be quite...
That sounds so much fun.
Quite, I know. Yeah. I was like, challenging, but I'm like, oh, this is going to be good because there's opportunities there for wayfinding. There's obviously physical opportunities. Yeah. There's spatial. There's digital. There's everything. Yeah. I mean, the way that they're set up.
And all the different shops and the different personalities. And
So that's going to be quite fascinating. And then alongside those pieces of work, we're setting up as... most of our stuff is going to be under NDA.
Mm-hmm.
So even at the end of some of these pieces, we can't actually show talk them, which it. Is really frustrating. So we are devising a parallel, essentially, stream of work for our R&D.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working on a project at the moment around accessible design cards.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit like IDEO's method cards. I don't know if you know those.
Yeah, I do.
So we've got our own set of method cards, actually. Mm-hmm. But the cards are going to be used for designers as a checklist, so along the way. And then there's also activities, and they're based around all of the five senses and so on. So we're going to develop that. And we're currently in the phase of like testing it. We've run a couple of workshops. Mm-hmm. We've got some focus groups coming in and so on. So that will be coming out hopefully over the next month. And into the new year as well. And then we've got a couple of other kind of smaller R&D.
Just a few things you've got going on.
We like keeping ourselves busy.
Okay. So I'm wondering if I can ask you before you leave, two questions that I ask everyone.
Sure.
Firstly, is there a career job in the creative industry that you know little about that you'd like to know more about? And then hopefully I could get someone in that role on the podcast. And also another woman in the creative industries that I could interview on Greater Than 11%.
Yeah, sure. So I think I know I was having a chat to you earlier about it's quite difficult to kind of come up with that sort of creative role. But I would love, and this is all self-interest really, but I'm getting into the detail around designing for VR and using grid-based layouts in order to do that. And it's this crazy ass grid them. So my architect at the moment has managed to design something in SketchUp that we walked through the other day, which was great. I was like, we need to use this for everything. And then on top of that, it was designing within that space and designing in the sense of that 360. I mean, if there's anyone in that realm, not necessarily even just filming for VR, but designing within that, I'd always love to know everything possible about that. And then when it comes to another woman, the one that pops into my mind, and I imagine though getting her is going to be like stapling jelly to a wall because she's so busy, is Fura, who is an amazing ECD over at Sapient.
Mm-hmm.
And she is super talented, very direct, great sense of humour, very dry sense of humour. And I think people would very much benefit from hearing her talk about the mayhem of her day.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Yeah,
hopefully we get her on.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Lauren, it's been fabulous speaking to you, fascinating speaking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.